Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Introductions for accomplished women like Dr. Lee Quinby could go on, but I won't. A brief overview. An expert in apocalyptic and millennial belief in American society, Lee's academic career spans more than 30 years. In 2012, she retired as distinguished lecturer at the William E. McCauley Honors College of the City University of New York, a position she held for 6 years. She's also taught at Brooklyn College and at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Lee is an author. She wrote 3 books. She's an editor. And she's a filmmaker. In 2010, she wrote and directed Facing the Waves, a documentary about a gang member turned surfer entrepreneur. She's the co-founder of the True Delta Project, a nonprofit multimedia initiative targeting the cultural assets of the Mississippi Delta. The project spawned True Delta, a 37-minute documentary she wrote, co-directed, and produced in 2012. The film focuses on aging blues musicians, educators, business leaders, and Delta Blues Museum members whose goal it is to keep the blues alive and to take a line from the film, as one generation passes on, another carries on. Lee also wrote and directed Howl and Mad, a Mississippi blues family man. The film follows Bill Perry, who grew up picking cotton in Mississippi, then moved to Chicago to make a new life for himself. However, his real success came when he returned to his roots some 40 years later as Howl in Mad. Lee Quinby, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy.
First of all, what is apocalyptic and millennial belief in American society? You got to dumb this down for somebody like me. What does that mean?
Well, basically, the apocalypse is the end of the world. And the millennial part is the dream of a greater future beyond the end of the world. So it really varies depending on who holds the belief. There are all shades of apocalypse, for example. So you have religious apocalypse.
Right.
And the millennial part of the religious apocalypse is that there will be, you know, a special place in eternity that's for the beings that who were elected to survive the end of the world, either through a supernatural, usually through heaven, or supernatural act of God.
And how much of what you teach has the religious thread through it?
The history in American culture is one of a religious background. Calvinists who came to settle in this land brought that belief with them. And, you hear the term the New Jerusalem or the city on the hill in relation to the United States. That's part of their rhetoric about having come here as special agents of God to create a better world. So sometimes apocalyptic belief suggests that everything deserves to be destroyed except for, a few predestined people. And then there's another side of it that's a little more millennial that says that, and this can be religious or secular, that says that people can help advance the society, that we can do what's necessary to prepare the world for becoming a New Jerusalem, becoming the city on the hill or the place that's a heaven on earth. So it really ranges, but it starts with a religious belief. And then, of course, today people think of it in popular culture terms.
But what's so interesting about this is how many people have predicted the end of the world, and it hasn't happened.
Right. We have 2,000 years of failed predictions.
So I kind of feel confident that at least in my lifetime, I'll be able to just continue to go out to dinner and all these other things.
Well, I feel that way, too. But there are people who, and a significant portion of the American population, who do expect the end times to come anytime soon. You know, it's always imminent, as you say, and it's been that way for millennia now. And it's interesting that it doesn't stave off that kind of fervor.
People are still strong believers.
Yes, uh-huh, yes.
Has it gotten worse for people? Are we really headed for the end faster than we would have been X amount of years ago?
Well, it depends on the perception. In the religious version, there have been misreadings, and that explains the failed predictions. That's how they see it.
Misreadings or misinterpretations?
Either misinterpretation of biblical text. The book of Revelation is one in the New Testament that is an important text for people who do believe that it's imminent. But also understanding of culture changes. So in some sense, the time we're living in always seems decadent to some. Mm-hmm. It always seems to be a mess politically, or there have been constant wars, and that's always evidence of difficulty. There are diseases that run rampant, pandemics and so on. So you can see where it plugs in.
Mm-hmm.
So in my study with students and in my writing, we've talked about the religious foundation, but I've been more interested personally in the way in which some of the urgency and the moral absolutism associated with apocalyptic belief has been translated into political rhetoric and rather intense nationalism and what's called exceptionalism, where it's the belief that the United States is the most moral country in the world and therefore we have the right to tell everybody else
what
how
to do.
Act. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not new.
It's part of the history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so there's, in the history, there are these sides that are taken. So in the Civil War, both sides felt that they were the ones that were elected by God to win that war. In the Revolutionary War before that, against the British.
Well, there's this kind of, I would call it almost arrogance, that people have that it's my way or the highway.
That's my perspective as well. But I do understand what happens when people believe it in a more fulsome way,
mm-hmm.
And so I try to be respectful of that belief system, but I don't hold it myself. So as a secular critic, I've looked at this belief system in the country.
And then go the millennial route. So then what happens?
Well, in the millennial side, there are frequently secular millennial groups, and we've seen that over time as well. In the 19th century, there were communal efforts to try to create a better society. Certainly in the 1960s and 70s, there, again, were communal efforts to do that, a different politics frequently. And
some people may call that cult.
Yes, but I think it's useful to try to keep the word cult in a more narrow sense. Robert J. Lifton is the person a lot of us rely on to say if there are certain numbers of steps that are taken in a given group, then that would constitute a cult. And most of the ones that have appeared on the American landscape are not truly cult-like.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have all the elements that would constitute that kind of obedience to a leader and charismatic leader. Jonestown, for example.
That's what I was thinking of in particular.
Yeah, that would be an example of one, and Waco as well.
Of course.
But then there are these other utopian or millennialist efforts. I would say, the civil rights movement in America and the feminist movement in America have had important millennial impulses to improve society.
For sure.
In the name of equality. So, again, it's like the term gets looser as you extend the range, but, that's an important element of our history.
But what's so interesting about this, not knowing anything at all about it, taking a subject matter like this and teaching it, is it's so varied and it's so wide.
That's true. And
you have a lot to talk about.
We have a lot to talk about. And students come to the subject with, their own interest. And so because there's so much to talk about, some of them will be more interested in the religious component. Others will be interested in the political. And others just love apocalyptic film and TV shows and zombie shows, And so you have to cover a lot of territory.
I was going to say, you have to please a lot of people.
Right.
So this obviously begs the question, how do you go from apocalyptic and millennial belief in society to the blues in Mississippi? What the hell does that mean? How did you do that? Or why did you do it?
Well, you could say that my focus is on suffering no matter what.
Okay, touche.
But, there is an element of the blues that is all about hard times. I mean, there's celebratory blues, too. It's interesting. It's kind of an oxymoronic term to think of it that way. But I do find in the Mississippi blues a slightly different take on suffering than what the apocalyptic belief suggests. For example, it's seen more as just the way life is, and you suffer through it. Maybe you drink it off a little bit. You find you find your man, you find your woman, or whatever, And so there's an endurance that's part of the blues that's fascinating to me, and maybe it's because it's an antidote to the sudden end of the world, everything's over.
Sure, now this makes a lot of sense to me. I'm almost embarrassed by the question. I see an incredible connection here. And there's also a tenacity that is evident in that area, right?
Yeah.
In spite of all this hardship, I can hold on or I can make it better for myself, but that may not necessarily be true.
Well, I think there is some belief that it might get better, but it's not guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting because in the African-American tradition, there is apocalyptic belief in many of the denominations. So it's not that far from it. And there's also, there are blues songs that have apocalyptic symbols and, you know, words that are associated with the Book of Revelation. That's part of the early blues in particular. And yet there's just a slight difference. But you probably know about the blues as the devil's music versus gospel as God's
music. Mm-hmm.
So for a long time there was that big conflict throughout the South and where the blues were born.
That's interesting. Talk about that.
Well, so early on, the blues were just seen as a movement away from gospel music and from the sermons that people
would hear. An organized religion
in general. Partly that was because a lot of use of alcohol. Liquor was one of the themes, and womanizing. A lot of the blues singers were men. So you can see where it was seen as sinful. Mm. And so preachers would preach against the blues as one of the elements or temptations that would bring, you know, take people out to the juke joints on Friday night, and be sinning. And so then they were trying to warn people away from that. But I think it's also the case from the beginning of blues that a lot of the blues singers grew up in the church. They learned their music through singing gospel, playing, you know, gospel music. And for them, it wasn't such a distinction. And so a lot of them, you know, they were celebrating on Saturday night and they were praying on Sunday
morning. So there's crossover.
Absolutely crossover. And that's, in the last few decades, that's certainly been recognized.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Lee Quinby, professor, author, editor, and documentary filmmaker. And we're talking about the True Delta Project, about kind of saving the blues scene in the Mississippi Delta area. So that now makes perfect sense to me, how you were drawn to that. But what sparked creating this project? I mean, it's one thing to have a connection, and it's another thing to do something about it. And you really did something about it.
Well, I want to give credit to my co-producer and my co-founder for the True Delta Project, the website, and the projects that we're working on together. Erickson Blakeney was a student of mine at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and he graduated in the mid-'80s, mm-hmm. and we remained friends. He lives here in New York. He's African-American, and he has family in Mississippi. So one night over dinner, when he knew I had made my first film, the one about the surfer.
Yes, which we're definitely going to talk about because that sounds really bizarre.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He said he had been thinking, you know, for some time about the blues in Mississippi and would I be interested in working with him. And I said, sure, let's go. And so we assembled our crew and went down to Mississippi. So he's really got those connections in a way that I didn't. I grew up in the South, in Florida, which is, you know, but it was the southern part,
yes.
side of Florida that mm-hmm. I grew up in. My family is very southern. And so I grew up with the blues and loved the music. But, you know, I didn't have those kind of connections that Erickson had. And so it's just worked out as a great team. We have some ongoing projects also in Mississippi, but the initial introduction and initiative was Erickson's.
But what's the difference between the state of blues in Mississippi as compared to New Orleans? Or is that naive on my part?
No, it's a good question. One way to think about it is that the Mississippi Delta region is seen as the early place that blues...
Birthplace?
The birthplace of the blues. There are a couple of places that claim that they were the real origin. Clarksdale, Mississippi is one because of the crossroads, but there are others in the area. And of course, that makes sense because there were people singing the blues out of kind of plantation songs for a long time. It emerged out of that. But then with African-American immigration, the blues quickly went to other locations, New Orleans, Chicago, some in New York, some in Texas. So you have the blues traveling.
As people were looking for work.
That's right. Yes, and they were leaving the South in the large immigrations that went north, and,
sure.
but also to New Orleans, and so in each of those locations, it blended with the other music. One of the things about the blues, this is for me the importance of what we call True Delta. The truth about the blues is that it evolves quickly and rapidly and immerses itself with other kinds of musical forms. So in New Orleans, you have a blend of blues, jazz, ragtime kind of music.
Yes.
You know, Chicago blues has a different kind of flavor. Here in New York, we have a blues scene, and it has a different feel to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, all of these cities have traveling musicians from all the areas, so now, you know, there's a larger
exposure.
Blend. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the blues is actually quite important internationally now. A lot of the musicians from the Mississippi Delta that I know that are in the film, they appear internationally. They're known more sometimes outside the United States than they are in the United States.
So Erickson Blakely said to you, we got a really serious situation going on in the South, that this amazing history and culture could just evaporate. Did he sound the death knell for you, that you were unaware of this?
Well, he was concerned about that, but neither of us really believed that that was going to happen. Because we hold this idea that it evolves quickly and that the blues has changed a lot over time, there are people who will say the authentic blues are dead and there's something else is replacing it. I don't actually hold that. I think the blues is always kind of changing.
Evolving.
It's always evolving. It's always changing in some ways. It could die out, obviously, as a musical form. But one of the things that a lot of musicians say, and I'm not a musician, so I rely on them, is that for people to learn music, it's a good idea to start with the 12-bar blues, that you can get a foundation in the blues that will enable you to learn other music as well. So you can, you know, if you're interested in jazz, start with the blues. And of course, we know in the 60s, the late 60s, with the British invasion, they restored the blues to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happening over and over again as well, and I hope to be part of that again when we have made this film and some short films of some of the musicians who appeared in True Delta who have passed away recently. It's with the idea that we want people to know about this music and about, you know, the people who are continuing to make it vibrant, and we want to spread the word. So, you know, that's what Erickson and I are doing with the True Delta project.
So the project came first.
Well, actually, no, the film actually came first.
The film came first. And who bankrolled that?
Well, we were very fortunate. We did a Kickstarter campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I also had some support from Macaulay.
The college.
Honors College,
mm-hmm.
As a kind of research project. And also a very big fortune with the camera and and editing. With Daniel Cowan, who continues to work with us. And he was a student at the time. And so through his Opportunities Fund, he had some funding. So we were able to go to Mississippi, you know, and pretty much complete those costs as they were happening. And then we had a great Kickstarter campaign and were blessed, actually, with getting not only the amount of money that covered our cost and to pay ourselves back, but also a little more to go on. And with that, we were able to go to some of the film festivals, Mountain Film at Telluride, for example. And we were able to have Bill Perry come out to Telluride with us when True Delta screened there. And he performed with his son and daughter. And then they also came to Lincoln Center with the Mountain Film Society at Lincoln Center. So we were able, with our Kickstarter extra money, you know, to fund some of those activities. So that's how it got bankrolled. But I want to say, with a nonprofit effort like this, we are always looking for donations, and we need contributions mm-hmm. to keep this going.
Talk about Bill Perry. We're going to play a little bit of him singing, but how'd you find him?
Well,
who became Howl in Mad?
Right. Well, we first met him when we were filming for True Delta, and he was one of the performers on stage. The way we did True Delta was the Delta Blues Museum was just great. Shelley Ritter is the director there, and they had their annual event, which is in August, which is the Sunflower River Blues and Gospel Festival every August. And so the musicians would appear on stage, and then they'd come into the museum, and we interviewed them. And Bill was one of those. And it also is the case that he was very active in their arts and education program, working with kids who were learning how to play the music as well.
The next generation.
That's right,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he's very charismatic. He's a great performer and, you know, looked great on camera. So that was one reason we thought he would be perfect to go to Telluride with us for a Mountain Film. And what happened was that we would screen the film and then they would play.
Do a Q&A also?
Q&A, but then they would also perform
mm-hmm.
a couple of songs. And
mm-hmm.
then they did some gigs around the town, and it was very popular. I had not ever met his family until Telluride. And I was watching this family, and I thought, this is beautiful, this family. And it turns out Pauline Perry has been his wife at that time for 45 years. They're still married. It's been 47 years now. And his son, Billy Jr., who's also a very gifted jazz musician, plays keyboard, and his daughter, Sharo Perry. So just on the spot, you know, it was one of those revelations.
Like, you had a moment.
I'd like to make a film about you. You know?
How old is he?
Bill is 66.
Oh, he's young.
Well, he's one of the younger. Yes, he's been around a long time, but he's in his
and a very
what we think of as young now.
This is his calling. This is his career. He's active. He plays all over the place.
Yes, he plays primarily in the South, mm-hmm. but he travels across the United States. You know, when he gets gigs elsewhere, he just came back from Italy. He and his daughter performed at a festival in northern Italy.
So he comes back from Chicago, returns to his roots, and reinvents himself for all intents and purposes.
Yes, and let me tell you a little bit about his history, because you'll see in Hallie Mad, the film, mm-hmm. He tells about his story. But his family had been in Mississippi for generations, and he grew up picking cotton, sort of stopped school in eighth grade, had never, as he said, never been in a place with indoor plumbing, you know, and moved to Chicago when he was 13. His mother moved them there. And so then he had a very different kind of cultural life in, you know, urban
area. Yeah, culture shock.
Culture shock, but became part of the gospel music scene there. And he had learned guitar when he was still in Mississippi and then, you know, and then continued playing. And so he was partly self-trained, and he learned from other musicians. And he went from gospel to kind of popular music while he was in Chicago. But and then that career was not—he wasn't really just making a huge success as he had hoped. And he and his family, they moved to California. So there were California years where he sort of got out of the music business. But he never gave up on his dream. And he's a songwriter as well as a musician. And I think it was just something he decided finally he was going to go back to Mississippi. And talk about culture shock for the kids. Hmm. They grew up in L.A.
Yeah, really.
And that was the big transition for them. But he was home again. And Pauline, his wife, is also from Mississippi. She's from the Jackson, Mississippi area. So they returned home, you know, and their children were in middle school and high school at the time. And they formed the band The Perrys, Bill and his son and daughter, and started performing in that area. And it was just before he moved to Mississippi that he came up with the Howling Mad.
Yeah, it's Howlmadd.
That's right.
Does it have a particular significance?
Well, I think it's a kind of tribute to Howlin' Wolf, a very, you know, well-known blues artist from earlier. Mm-hmm. And Bill's a funny guy because he's you know, very sane. You know, he's very stable.
Yeah, he's not M-A-D-D.
That's right. But he's got an energy that I think the name gets at, mm-hmm. and you feel it, you know, when you watch him perform, and he can do the Howlin' Mad thing really well.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Lee Quinby, author, professor, editor, and filmmaker, and co-founder, I should say, of the True Delta Project. Do you feel really good about where this all is now? I mean, that this True Delta Project has kind of made the blues in the Mississippi Delta area secure, and it has a much stronger foundation now. You feel optimistic? You feel hopeful?
I feel optimistic, but I'm not going to give it that much credit yet. Plus, there are other institutions that really get a lot of credit for keeping the blues alive. Mm-hmm. The Delta Blues Museum, for example.
Well, you all work together.
Yes. I mean, mm-hmm. they've been very helpful to us, and you know, we hope to continue having that kind of close relationship. But I think media is just a wonderful way to get the word out about something. So I feel good about the fact that we've had a strong festival run for True Delta, and we've already got two acceptances for festivals coming up for the Howlin' Mad documentary. And that, you know, that runs, we just started that, so that'll run for a year or a year and a half.
You know, it's really interesting about filmmakers, and particularly documentary filmmakers and festivals. Where do I see this movie? How do you get it out there? And it's interesting. It's 37 minutes. Is this a PBS special? What do you do?
Well, that would be my dream.
Well, call them up.
Right. Well, there, you know, PBS is also always getting its own works done. You know, they have lots of plans for things in the works, I'm sure. But it is possible to get a PBS attention through festivals and sometimes through colleges and universities that will screen a film, and that's one of the avenues. And we're hoping with Howling Mad that that's the case. I sometimes will go to colleges, I've been, you know, asked to do a lecture and show the film, and then we talk about it. So there are a couple of avenues like that.
I had interviewed a wonderful woman who made a documentary on the second wave feminism, and it is in schools and at libraries, and it's a history lesson, I would assume, even though the kids aren't paying for that, but it's an important tool. I would assume that that's where you would like your movies to be as well.
Absolutely. The educational route is really important, and we don't make a lot of money on the DVDs. And institutions will buy them, and then they can show them to their classes. Howling Mad will be on sale on our website, you know, for $10.
And your website is?
Is TrueDeltaProject.org.
Mm-hmm.
We keep it at a price that's affordable so that people can see it, pass it on, give it as gifts. Then, that's one way that these things get seen. But I would, my dream is to try to create this film and other films about the blues that would get some kind of TV coverage. Something like PBS would be great.
I would also assume that these are labors of love, that you're not going to get rich from making these movies. So
right.
it's a different drive that propels you.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. I care about these people and in their careers, actually, and it's rewarding, to be able to support them and get the word out about them. I never thought I was going to get rich. Fortunately, I'm in retirement now. This is my full-time job. And I can do that through the donations and through the DVD sales. And if people, help support this project, if it's meaningful to them,
mm-hmm.
we would love for them to come on board.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, that's the case. Yeah, I think a labor of love is probably the best term for it.
Where do you get off to be a professor, and an author, and think that you could be a filmmaker?
Well, it's true that I don't have training. I'm training myself in the process. So I guess where I get off on that is that my experience with American culture, since that's been my scholarship, gave me some access to trying to understand the way that the blues emerged in the South. And since I knew how to write books and essays, a documentary form was probably the best choice for me to begin with, because I felt like it wasn't that far removed.
Mm-hmm.
You write it, and it turns out that there are enough differences that you have to actually train.
Well, you're on the job training, is right.
Yes, and I tend to interview the musicians first and then write it. I don't go in with a written.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even really go in with an idea of what I'm going to come out with. I want to hear their stories. And I have to say, the interview part is what I love most about it.
Let's go back to the first film, which was Facing the Waves. How was that born?
First, I got the idea that I was going to make a film, partly because some of the students who I knew who were making films were so excited about it. They would show me what they had done. I thought, well, I'd like to try.
I was contagious.
It's contagious. And I asked Daniel, who was one of those types, who, we'd say, let me show you what I'm doing now, if he would work with me. And so he trekked out to Rockaway several times. But just as I was deciding that I was going to try my hand at filmmaking, I read a piece in the New York Times about this man named Bobby Vaughn, who had just opened a surf shop in Rockaway Park at that time. This was 2010. And he had such an interesting life story that it merited, this Times piece. So I live very close to where his surf store was. And just trotted over to the store.
And just got to know him.
Which had been open for a month and said, mm-hmm. I read this story and I'd like to make a film about you. And, of course, it helps if you're an educator, I think, if you say that, And he said, okay.
And it was telling his story, from certainly one extreme to another and turned his life around.
Yes, telling his story. And it was a difficult story. He had stood trial for a murder of his best friend. He tells us how that happened and then was ruled justified homicide. But Bobby he's a fascinating person. He had made literally millions of dollars in fashion in his early 20s with the Von Dutch line. He and Mike Cassell were co-founders of that line, which became a kind of celebrity icon with their hats and brands and stuff for a while. But he... I think they made some difficult business decisions, and then he also had this friend who had a criminal history and had been released from jail. He was trying to help his friend, but they were in a crowd that was drinking too much, doing partying too much. And anyway, he lost most of his money that was left from the company on the trial. So he just needed to have a new start. And he has a good heart, and so he decided,
and he was able to reinvent himself.
And he did reinvent himself, yeah.
Unlike you, you didn't reinvent yourself. You just added to yourself.
I think of it that way, yes.
Okay, that's terrific.
I think of myself as an educator in both in different forms.
In different, exactly, yeah. In different venues. It's
yes.
Wonderful. Dr. Lee Quinby, it was a pleasure to meet you. You have quite a story to tell, and I bet we're going to hear from you celluloidedly in the future, right? You're going to keep doing
I'll
your
keep
movies.
At this, yes, and thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. I'm Sandy Klein. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. And now to take us home, Bill Howlin' Mad Perry singing Miss Mary.
Miss Mary called me this morning. She said I could come back home. Miss Mary called me this morning. She said I could come back home. You see, I can't understand why I treated that woman so wrong.